was hanging out in the sauna. I was probably there for 20 minutes, 25 minutes on my own. And the sauna is massive too. You can imagine what it's like in the Four Seasons.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this guy cruised in with like a towel over his shoulder and his dick swinging around. Like, literally sat right next to me, like legs touching. I was like, did you see that Ferrari 599 out the front? And he goes, the black one. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, man, that's mine. I was like, holy shit. And I was like, what do you do? And he said, oh, I'm a neurosurgeon by profession, but I work for Bridgewater. And then he's a professor at Harvard and all these other universities and stuff over there. And I was like, sick, cool, man. He's like, what about you? And I was telling him about the hair care thing. And then he was like, do you know what, man? I was always thinking about doing like a women's skincare line, because all the actives and all the stuff that we do is basically at the end of the day like anti-aging. And I was like, man, it's a pretty crowded space though, you know. And not to be negative, but I was like, that's where the big girls and the big boys play, and like it's a whole thing. You gotta, you know, you'd have to do it full time. And he's like, yeah, I know, it's kind of why I haven't done it. And I said, why don't you do like a really high-end men's one? And I said, I can't think of any off the top of my head that are like as crazy as you're talking about. And he was like, man, fucking good idea. And he goes, tell you what, he goes, you want to go halves in it? And he was like, I'll do all the back end science stuff and you brand it and then we'll go from there. I was like, fuck yeah.
In 1837, Horace Mann created the education system, a system at the time designed to pump out factory workers and professors. The same system that is still being used today in the 21st century. Now, Mann's system is backfiring. We are being molded by the same industrial system that has existed for close to 200 years. That system delivers us into a digital economy that has no need of our outdated skills. This isn't our teachers' fault. This isn't the government's fault. This is due to a rapidly changing world full of technology and unforeseen circumstances. And us Gen Zs are caught in the middle. Welcome to the Driven Young Podcast, the podcast for stressed, overwhelmed young Australians, teaching you practical life skills you can implement now to set yourself up in life. And now your host, Byron Dempsey.
All right, Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Very looking forward to this episode. I've met you at an event where you were kind of just speaking and just kind of sharing a bit about your story. So you've started a company called Patrick's.
Yeah, yeah. Shameless self-promotion.
Yeah. And it's a men's skincare company. And we'll get into that, of course. And you do a bit more hair products and whatnot.
Yeah.
But you've built an incredible brand. And wherever this conversation goes, that's where it goes.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I really like how much you talk about your like networking ability.
Yeah.
When I say networking, I mean getting drunk with people, meeting them in saunas. Like, yeah, you seem to have met people in every possible situation, and that's led to millions of dollars of investment into your company.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, I ask every guest this question to get started, and that's, what did you do after high school?
I didn't do very well in high school, so I kind of I had to do an apprenticeship. So I was an electrician. I came up to Sydney from the South Coast where I grew up.
Yeah.
And spent 4 years in sort of Bondi doing an electrical apprenticeship, and then the day I got it, got my ticket, I went to London and lived over there for like 3 years and sort of partied on, and as you do when you're in your 20s.
Yeah. And were you using your apprenticeship in London?
Yeah, yeah. And at the time, man, it was great. You know, like as a tradesman in London, we were cleaning up. I was making like kind of $4,000 or $5,000 a week.
Holy crap.
Because the currency conversion was like 3.5 back then. And we had all these tax dodges set up with the Isle of Man and Isle of Wight, and you could send your money offshore and then bring it back without any tax. And, you know, I don't think you can do it anymore, but...
good old days.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. It was, and to be that young in London, which was like rad, you know, you've got all the music and fashion and everything else going on. And I met my wife there, actually. We're still together now. It's like 23 years later or something. Yeah, had a great time. Traveled all over Europe, all over the States, and yeah, paid for everything. But I hated it. Oh, man. And excuse my French. I don't know if you can swear in here, but I fucking hated it. I wish that I had gone better in school to then not have to have done it, because it was, I don't know, it just seemed like such a waste of time. Even though I'm grateful for what it gave me, but it just, like, if I could pass that lesson on to anyone else, be like, just for the last year or something, just try a bit harder,
because
it just opens up so many more doors. And also, like, everyone I know that went to university, it seems like they had a fucking great time. You know what I mean? Like, if it's not just for the partying and stuff like that, but like the networks and the connections you can meet there, and everyone else is kind of doing good. And yeah. That said though, all the tradies now are the new millionaires, right?
I was about to say, I mean, trades are, yeah, they're making more money than most people in uni.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's such a high demand.
Mate, I go to all these car events and, you know, all the Lambos and Ferraris and all the sickest cars are owned by like gyprockers and sparkies and painters and plumbers and, you know, like the tradies are the new rich.
Because what they'll do is they'll usually, they'll do the trade for like 5, 6, 7, 10 years and they'll start their own company.
Yeah.
And then they just bank for the company.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great path. I mean, the good thing about the trade is it's such a universal skill.
Yeah.
You can go anywhere in the world and people need tradies.
And it's practical as well. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, especially being an electrician, if you go into design or, you know, product manufacturing or whatever you do, you kind of have a bit of an idea of the way things work and why and how, and gives you that kind of function over form bit, which I like.
No, I love that. I mean, one of my biggest things for young people is like travel while you're young.
Yeah, 100%. My kids are getting, for their birthdays, for when they're 18 or 21 or whatever, getting around the world ticket and go and have some fun and what's out there. And it also makes you appreciate home, you know? Like, you don't realise how good, you know, Sydney is, or, you know, Bondi in particular where I live. I love it, man. Like, the other day I came back from LA and New York and Miami and just been, you know, on a 3-week craziest trip. And I like nearly cried coming down the hill. And I'm not a real crying guy, but I was just like, fuck, it's so beautiful, you know? And the water was like blue as, there's no pollution. Like, the sand's beautiful. All the people are, you know, most of the time pretty cool. It's just a vibe. I really like it.
We, because I mentioned I was camping last weekend.
Ooh.
And one of the guys there, he's a great guy. He's had a real rough upbringing, but a great guy.
Yeah.
And he was saying, because I think he's like Irish or something. I don't even got an accent. He's got family and friends in Ireland.
Yeah.
And he's just like, whenever I'm over there, all they do is just go to the pub.
Yeah.
And he's just like, just because, and they were like, mate, you're so lucky. You can do all these things. In Ireland, the weather's shithouse all day. All we can do is go to the pub. Yeah, and it's like you're camping on the beach on your weekends between work. And it's like, we're just stuck going to the pub.
Yeah. And man, like, it's easy to take that stuff for granted, you know?
You finished high school. You didn't do that well. Go trade. Went and traveled. Met your wife there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did she come back to Australia with you?
Yeah.
What's the story from there?
Mate, so then, like, I'll try and keep it brief because that's kind of a bit of the journey. But then, so it was kind of as simple as I was sick of getting shit haircuts at the time. And I didn't want to, it was like really cheap barbershops or kind of women's salons that weren't, you know, catered for guys. And they didn't really want to do the service because they get so much more money per customer from doing it.
Yeah, right.
Female. And the barbershops were barbershops, you know, they were pretty terrible. If you wanted like a David Beckham style or something else, you'd get, you know, called this and that if you asked for something, anything crazy. So then I had this idea to do like a men's salon, I guess, as opposed to a barbershop. And the concept kind of evolved and evolved. And then, when I was young, my mum worked in a real estate agent in Marimbula, and there was this house that came up, some guy got in trouble with the law and sort of did a runner and he sold this apartment for like 60 grand. Anyway, my mum organised a loan for me and stuff and I was just paying it off as I was doing my apprenticeship because it wasn't much over 30 years. It was like, you know, $50 a week or something.
Right.
So once I got that, by the time I got back from the UK being a Sparky, then I had the idea to do this kind of concept salon thing. That had gone up in value to like 250 grand. So I sold it and then paid off the loan and then I had about 200 grand left and I used that to fit out this like salon in Bondi Junction. And man, from day one, this thing just pumped. It was like, it was crazy. And it was $60 for a haircut back, you know, this is 15, 16 years ago.
Because I pay 55 and that's a lot.
I know.
And that's today.
Yeah, man, it was expensive. But it was cool, right? Like, so we were the first licensed hairdressers in the country. So we had like a licensed bar and we had deals with Ducati. We had like Lamborghinis in there. We had like, it was a crazy place. People thought it was like a, I don't know, some kind of topless hairdressing or strip club. I don't know. Because we blacked out all the windows.
Right.
So more so the guys wouldn't get self-conscious if they were getting a haircut or getting a colour or whatever. And
that was something I hated as a kid where I got my haircut. It was like past the shops and everyone would just walk past. I'm like, I don't want to be walking past. I want to be like in a nice private area.
Yeah. But that was the whole concept for the shop. So the front was like a, you know, and this is how long ago it was. Like we had plasma screens everywhere. And at the time they were like, you know, they were bucks and not everyone had them. So we had plasma screens, iPads and, you know, like sort of Chesterfield couches where people could chill out and we had all magazines and stuff and iPads and things. And then we had like a full kind of cafe where you could get, you know, coffees and stuff, not food. But and then all the booze and cigar, British American Tobacco used to give us like so many cigarettes and and like cigars because it was the perfect sort of demographic for those guys to sell. And the booze would, you know, Diageo used to give us cases of whiskey every week, like, couldn't drink it all. I'd just give it away to all the guys. Right. You know what I mean?
How did you get those deals? Like, were the people you knew?
They usually approached us. Yeah. Because the place had like a pretty wild rep, you know?
Yeah.
And we say it was, you know, drug dealers to brain surgeons and everything in between. Yeah. It was like, it was the real, it was pretty crazy because it was expensive. Right. Mm. But and then that we ran that for maybe 9 years. And then the sort of story of the products then was that I was trying to find a brand to put in the store because we'd make more of our money selling products than actually doing a service, even at $60.
Right. Is that so common for most barbers?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it depends. Like if a barber's like a, you know, if he's cutting himself and running his own store, then you make good money. And depending on how quick the haircut is, you know, some of these guys can bash out a haircut in 10 or 15 minutes. Mm. And that means you could do 4 or 5 an hour. Whereas we do one every half an hour. And even now, most places do 45 minutes.
Yeah, mine's usually half an hour.
Yeah. And so we used to do half hour blocks, but that would be $120 in that half an hour just from the server. But it would almost cost me that much.
I was about to say, yeah.
To run the...
$120
yeah,
is nothing.
Our rent was like 100, was it 125 grand a year, which was expensive at the time. Plus everything else, you know, that we had to pay for and all the staff. There was, we had anywhere from kind of 15 to, I think we had 25 at one point. So it was big and it cost a lot to run. But then we could upsell products to, I think like 70 or 80% of our clients bought a product.
Right.
And that's anywhere from 30 to kind of $200 on top of the 60. And
that's
60.
Like, that's classic kind of, I guess, men, because we don't really know what we're doing in that space.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, well, I trust you guys. I trust this place. I'm going to trust the products you're giving us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was a big thing for us. Yeah, we didn't do like product sales. So if I said to you like, hey, do you want to take some shampoo today? Your auto reaction is just to go, nah, no, I'm cool, man, thanks. And then walk out, you know what I mean? Whereas we'd teach the guys how to use it in the chair. So say like, here's your styling product or whatever. Show them how to use it. Show them how much, you know, and then show them how to apply it and then send them on their way. Mm. And then they just walk straight up to the counter and grab it. You don't even have to sell it. And then if you say, oh man, if you're grabbing that, use that shampoo, it's sick. And then they would get that as well. And then all of a sudden you've got them up to $100. So that's a $160 ticket instead of a $60 one. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're giving them good stuff. Like at the time we used American Crew. And it was cool, but it wasn't kind of like multifunctional and it wasn't sort of super high end. And the shop was. But I was watching all these guys go straight across the road to like David Jones and spending so much money on like Tom Ford and Creed. And at the time, Clinique had just kind of released a men's range, which was basically their women's stuff packed in grey.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was...
charcoal.
Exactly. But it showed the demand for it, right? Like that stuff took off. So I was like, all right, let's try and find like a high-end brand to put in the shop just so we can sell at a high price.
Yeah.
And couldn't find one, man. And I think we're still kind of alone in the space. You know what I mean? It's so we thought, fuck it, let's just do it ourselves. And we tried to develop it in Australia for maybe 2 years and just couldn't get the formulations up to where I wanted them to be as far as like performance and then all the hair loss stuff as well and the fragrance and then the packaging. And it's like a complicated thing. And I drift over that like it was nothing. But
no,
it was
no,
like
no,
4 years. But
like in the chemistry and everything.
Yeah. So that sort of stuff, like you don't have to be a chemist to do it. You kind of give it to a lab and tell them what you want. So you give them a benchmark and then say, hey, look, we like this about this product. We like this about this. You know, can you make a version of that for us? Mm. So then Amy actually found my wife and the CEO now. She found a lab in Miami and she'd researched the lab and they'd done an equity deal with Tony and Guy years and years ago with TG and then Label M, which are like huge products brands in the sort of hairdressing world. And then we were like, fuck, if they've done an equity deal with those guys, there's a chance they might do one with us. And they don't, you know, they don't take phone calls and they don't answer emails or anything like that. I tried for 6 months to get something out of them. We got nothing, left a million voicemails and stuff. And then in the end, we were like, let's just go over there and check it out. So we flew to Miami, just went to the place, knocked on the door. And sure enough, the CEO like walked down the stairs as I was talking to the receptionist and the rest is kind of history. I asked him just to give me 5 minutes and he was like, you're not Patrick, are you?
And I was like, yeah. He'd seen the emails.
Yeah, well, it was more the voicemails. I think he picked up on the accent. And then, we spent the whole day with those guys. They basically blocked out the day and loved the idea, loved the concept. Because it hadn't been done before, like that multifunctional kind of really high-end, high-performance men's products. Mm. And for them too, it was like an open brief. So usually you give people like a budget per fill, right? So say you're making that, you might say, oh, we need to make that for $1. And then that sort of handcuffs the engineers and the guys working on the product. Whereas ours was just like open. So it was like, there is no budget. We just want to create the best product in each sort of division, I guess. And from that, that gets your chemists and everyone super excited, right? It's like giving an architect a brief of saying, hey man, you can change the skyline of New York and they're just going to freak out and love it.
Yeah,
it's
no
just
rules.
Like, yeah, it's no
whatever
rules.
You want.
Yeah, so these guys, and they're so handcuffed usually by using shit ingredients to try and make it come in on budget, whereas ours was the opposite. So the guys were all stoked about it and like, yes, finally I can actually make this thing I've been thinking about or use this ingredient that I've found that, you know, was usually too expensive for everyone else. And then that's how it all kind of rolled. And then so Le Dove, who's the company in Miami, they make all the hair care stuff, they invested in the brand after that kind of meeting. And then from there, they took us up to Chicago where we make all our packaging. And again, I was going to do the packaging here in Sydney, and we wanted custom packaging over kind of, you know, the traditional stuff you just buy off the shelf, just because it gives you an instant point of difference on on the shelf. But to develop it in Sydney, we were looking at kind of $400,000 to $600,000. And I'd already designed it, but I hadn't, like, you got to make molds and everything like that and do CAD drawings, and it's like super complicated and expensive. But these guys in Chicago, they did like, they do free design work in exchange for a manufacturing contract.
Nice.
Yeah. So that saved me like all that capital straight off the bat.
It's the win-win.
Yeah. Yeah. The minimums were huge, but we're like, fuck it. If we're going to do it, let's just do it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, that kind of ran from there. We developed all the, like, the styling products. So there's four styling products back then, and then two shampoos and two conditioners. Way over designed the shampoo bottle. It's kind of like, sits in my office now and I laugh at it. It's like $1 million shampoo bottle that we never used. But yeah, and then that kind of, from there, we tested the products in the shop for maybe 4 years. And then the product thing, well, sort of, there's a whole bunch of stuff to it as well. Like, I ended up going back to school and doing an advanced diploma of corporate finance so I could raise money to raise capital for this product business, because it was so expensive. And the shop was making good money, but not enough to pay for like a product brand. So I ended up, I did that for 12 months, and that made me like a corporate advisor, which it meant I could raise my own money. And then just had a night at the shop. Everyone kind of knew about the products because they've been testing them for so long. And then did a pitch night at the shop, and three guys invested enough to, we raised $250,000 at a 2.5 mil val. That was sort of to fund the concept. And then that got us to Miami and got everything rolling. And then once we were into production, then I raised another $500,000 at a 5 mil valuation. And then that funded the next step, which got it all produced. And then maybe 2 years after that, we raised $2 million at a 12.5 mil val, which then kind of got us to almost where we are now. And then I've done a smaller kind of raise. Well, it actually went for debt a couple of months ago just to keep up with the growth. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, what a cool story.
Yeah, mate. Well, it was, I mean, there's so much more to it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if we got like, 5 hours.
Yeah, yeah. And the brand, the launch is, I think, what we did cleverly without, you know, being arrogant about it. But it, like, it was, rather than working your way up in the sort of hierarchy of stores and stuff, so rather than going into barbershops and then salons and then, you know, chemists and then maybe into your Myers and DJs and everything else and then going up like that. We just thought, like, let's just start at the top. So Mr. Porter was just getting big at the time. That was about 7 or 8 years ago. And they didn't have any grooming on their site. And so I was like, let's just go and pitch it to them. And we got it in there. We got a meeting with them. Amy was like 36 weeks pregnant with her first kid and had to get special permission from Qantas and everything and doctor's letters to let her fly. And then, yeah, we pitched it to those guys. They loved it. That was in New York. And there was a whole other story behind all that too. I was kind of super lucky how we did it. And then they launched us on Mr. Porter as the first grooming brand, and it just blew up from there. And then that got us, cause it was a lot bigger in the UK. That got us like Selfridges. Cause once you get on Mr. Porter, you get Selfridges. Once you get Selfridges, you get Harrods. Once you get Harrods, you get Harvey Nicks. Once you get Harvey Nicks, you get End, and you know, the list goes on.
Yeah. All the other
and then all of a sudden you're like a fairly punchy, you know, business to business brand. And what they all do is then give you credibility. So it's like, if this is stocked in Harrods or this is stocked in Selfridges, it must be good shit, right? Because the buyers, you know, they know what they're doing and they don't stock, you know, shit brands, especially in those kind of department stores. And it, man, it just went mad. It like went crazy. And then we did the kind of the same version in the States. So we launched with Barney's in New York. And that was only in there for about 3 months before they went bust. They still owe me about $50,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I mean, the email they sent out was worth the 50 every day of the week, because it just, they did a blast out to their kind of database of like, here's this new men's brand,
right?
Blah, blah,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It just pumped. And then they ended up closing. But because Barney's had it, then obviously Bergdorf grabbed it, who's across the street, and they're kind of arch rivals. Mm. And then once you get Bergdorf, you get Neiman's. Once you get Neiman's, you get Saks. Once you get Saks, you get
Nordstrom. I don't even know these things, but I assume they're
they're just big department stores over there, but they're really like high end ones. So that, and again, that went like crazy. And the business to business like model isn't great. Like the margins are pretty shit. And it's a hard one. You know, you got staffing, and we spend a lot of time and effort trying to keep the products on the shelf, stocked up, looking good, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's a tough sale in a department store when you traditionally would sell that stuff in a salon, or a barbershop. But that's all got to do with the kind of the business side of the brand, where we don't stock in barbershops or salons, because as part of the exit strategy for if and when we sell in the next few years, that's like an upside for them. Like say it was a L'Oreal or an Estee, they could just plug our brand into like, you know, hundreds of thousands of salons all around the world, and they could make back whatever they paid for the brand.
Right. Yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah. But that's a lot of work that you just go, you guys do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to leave him some cream, you know?
Yeah.
So direct-to-consumer for us now is just massive. And I think because those big department stores give you all the credibility, and then people see it on your website and everything else, and then go, okay, well, if it's there, it must be good. And then they trust, you know, then they buy like a styling product or a shampoo or conditioner or any kind of, you know, skincare on a website, which traditionally is not that done, you know what I mean? Like it's usually people like to, you know, look and feel and smell stuff. And but I think if you've got all that cred behind you and the clinical data and everything else, then they trust it and buy it. And we have a money back guarantee, obviously. Yeah, so, yeah. But which never gets used, which is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, what a cool story. I love how, and just you're not, the salon is not open anymore.
Nah, man, I actually couldn't wait to close it in the end. It was just chaos. Mm. It was more the staff. The staff was the only really hard part about it.
It's always people, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was hard to motivate them. They weren't generally motivated by money. And a lot of them really, you know, didn't want to be hairdressers. It was more of a thing where, like we were talking about before, like most of them like didn't go well in school. So I ended up just getting an apprenticeship and working in a salon or whatever. And then kind of fast forward 10, 15 years, they're still doing the same thing. So they never, it wasn't really what they wanted to do with their lives.
Yeah.
The ones that were really good were generally the ones that had done another job and then come back or come to that later in life, and because they loved it. And then they were like throat slitters, man. They were the best hairdressers because they wanted to do it.
Well, I was just getting my hair cut like 2 days ago, and this exact conversation came up because like the boys, it's a good experience, $55 for a cut, which is a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I, you know, I enjoy it. And yeah, great guys. But yeah, one of them's like 22, he's cutting my hair. And he's like, yeah, I don't want to be a barber the rest of my life.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, he's just in Western Sydney. He's figuring it out. And I was like, yeah, I mean, it was tough because I guess for me, I'm always encouraging people to pursue something that they really want to do.
So I did it heaps. Heaps of our like hairdressers ended up going on to do other stuff. And hopefully I had a bit of a hand in it. But I was like, look, you don't have to do this, you know, whatever it is you want, like figure out what you're good at. And then life's easy, man. Like I love what I do now. Mm. Like it's so much fun. Mm. You know, I get to travel around the world, make cool shit, meet heaps of amazing people, stay in crazy places. It's like, you know, I wouldn't say it's a dream come true, but it cost me to get there.
Yeah.
It wasn't like time and money and just, yeah. You can't really describe to people like running your own, unless they run their own business. Like it's full on, man. It's all consuming. You know what I mean? And then you chuck kids and, you know, real life in the mix as well. And it's really gnarly, but the payoff is worth it, I think. You know what I mean? Mm. And if I can inspire anyone to kind of give up what they're doing and get after it in whatever their chosen, you know, field is, that makes me feel so good, you know?
And yeah, that's kind of what I do. That's why I do what I do. Yeah, like I really try to, like this podcast is all about. It's like people underestimate how much talent they have. It's like this Tim Ferriss quote. It was something along the lines of most people underestimate what they could achieve. Therefore, they settle for mediocrity. Yeah. Therefore, the competition for mediocrity is way more fierce than it is to be like successful. And because people just settle here. It's like, whoa, you can actually go up here. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of work. You might not make money for 3, 4, 5 years or whatever. And it's going to be a lot of hard work. But like most people could achieve it. They just have a lot of doubt. Or they go,
100%. And I talk to people all the time that have got like normal jobs, right? And they're like, oh man, I got this idea for this app, or I got this, or I got that, and whatever it might be. And then the first thing I say to them is like, the worst case scenario is, say you quit your job, you know, you do the app or whatever, and, you know, it might just go crazy and you might become a gazillionaire and be really happy in what you're doing and blah, 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 and just change your life. But the worst case scenario is it doesn't work out, and then you're back to exactly what you're doing now. Because if you leave in a good way, you'll probably get your job back.
Yeah.
And you'll probably get more money because you've had so much experience growing and trying to start a brand, even if you fuck it up.
Mm.
But you're never going to go back to where you already were. So it's like, there's zero downside to doing it.
And that's what I say, especially when you don't have kids.
Yeah,
and you're 24 years old.
Oh,
20,
man,
like you do it after. You do it now when you got kids. Well, the downsides are you can't afford to pay for your kids to go to school, whatever.
Yeah. But it's like, just time. Time with kids is the wind up.
Exactly. Yeah. And you might be working your ass off rather than seeing your kids.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, man, while you're young, take as many risks as possible. Like do the thing you wanted to do. Because like there's a woman who wrote a book, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. She's actually in in Australia. And she spent like 20 years in a nursing home, and she came across 5 common regrets. And she's like, so often people very, very rarely regret the risks they took.
Yeah.
But they always regret the risks that they never took.
Exactly.
Because they go, what if?
Yeah, yeah.
What
yeah.
if I had pursued this thing? But now I'll never know.
Yeah. I mean, sort of goes to like talking to people too, and we're sort of talking about before, like all the crazy people that I've met around the world that have helped me out, like whether it's raising capital or like, you know, people that were movie stars that I had no idea, or or musicians or architects or whatever it is. Yeah. You just like, you never know who you're sitting next to, right? So I always talk to people, whether it's bars or planes or trains or wherever I am. I'll always just strike up a conversation, not in a weird way, but I'm just like, hey man, how's it going? And then, you know, like three of my biggest investors I met in like gyms and saunas, weirdly.
And was that a strategy? Because I've heard a strategy is to go to like, yeah, it might cost you a lot of money to go to these gyms and saunas or whatever, but that's where the people you need to be meeting are. So yeah, it's like, it's worth the cost because you might meet.
I don't know if it was an intended strategy, but it was maybe a bit of luck. Yeah. Someone got me into Soho House years ago, and because I was traveling so much, I actually used the membership like you're supposed to. And, you know, I'd just be in the gym in the mornings and, you know, hanging out with people or drinking with people at night, and then someone knows someone, and then you end up talking about what you do, and they, you know, generally in those environments, it's like creatives and stuff like that. And then, yeah, one thing kind of leads to another, and before you know it, like, man, I remember telling stories in saunas and, you know, with like a room full of people just like listening to every word
because,
you know, they're all young and trying to get after it, any advice you can give them, and it's like all of a sudden everyone's listening in their undies sweating it up. But it's good. It's good fun, you know, and I think you could, yeah, you just never know. Like one of my bigger investors I met on a plane on the way, I got an upgrade from, and I never do it, but I got a business trip from London back to Sydney and sat next to this guy who was a Scottish guy. And him and I just became great friends after like 26 hours
together. Yeah, right.
You would. And it turns out he's like this, you know, throat-slitting investor who's just one of my heroes now. I love the guy. And he invested in the business. He was like, mate, give me a look at your IM. You know, I didn't know that he was into raising money or anything, or like, in, you know, he owned a fund. And sure enough, I met him for a coffee in Paddington, just around the corner here actually. And yeah, he loved the IM, invested in the business. Now he's probably one of our closest advisors. He's lent me... Oh, he's invested in the business and lent me like debt financing as well. And he's just like a guy I want to kind of be like, you know.
Is it like, because I talk a lot about like communication skills and building relationships, and it sounds like, you haven't gone into details, but it sounds like when you met these people, your intention wasn't to get money off it. It was just being genuinely interested and curious. You're just like, yeah, tell me
a
story.
I think if you go in with that intention, like I know a few sort of business coach, you know, people that tell you to stay in hotels that you can't afford and train in gyms that you can't afford and do all that sort of stuff to try and get like networks and connections. But just like, to me, it seems as a reek of desperation.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
I agree.
Whereas if you go in there with, you know, like an open, I don't know, I'd never go in for an ulterior motive, but like to just see how someone's doing, you know what I mean? Well, or have a chat, because I'm always on my own. That's the other thing, right?
Yeah.
So when I travel so much for work, it sounds all rock and roll and, you know, crazy, and it is, but it's kind of lonely, man. You're always by yourself. So any chance you get to have a chat with someone, whether it's, you know, I was going to write a book called Table for One because that's like my life, man. It's lonely. So then when you get to talk to someone at a bar or in a restaurant or in a gym or wherever you are, or on a train, like it's nice. It's a nice warm feeling, right?
Yeah, and it's cool. It's cool meeting people, hearing their stories.
Yeah, totally, man. And you'd never know who you're talking to. Like not all of them end up in investments and stuff, but that doesn't matter. That wasn't the point, right? But then the point is, once you do meet a couple of these people, generally they hang out in that world. So they're like, hey man, yeah, I'm in, you know, I want to invest in the business, blah, blah, blah. Talk to this guy's in New York. And I was telling you off mic that one of the guys I met in London in a gym, you know, I told him he looked as hungover as I did and he told me to fuck off. And then we ended up doing some like boxing together and hanging out. And then I gave him some products and I didn't know who he was. So it wasn't like a strategy to get him to invest. I didn't even know who the fuck he was. He was just a nice guy, right? Called John.
And what does giving some products cost you? Like nothing?
Oh, mate. Yeah. Like maybe 50 bucks, 100 bucks. And then, so I left them for him at the reception. And then literally half an hour later, he texts me going, bro, this stuff's amazing. Like you're not looking for any kind of investment, are you? And I was like, we were actually doing a capital raise. And I was like, do you know what? Yeah, I am. We're actually doing a raise. Do you want to take a look at the IM? So I met him for a drink and then I showed him the IM. He didn't even read it. He cut me a check for 250 grand.
Wow.
And still now one of my closest advisors. I love the guy. He's fucking cool. Every time I go to London, I stay at his place and you know, he's a good dude. And then basically straight after that meeting, he goes, man, you've got to talk to my mate Tom, who's in New York. He would love this kind of stuff and he's in the zone. He's, you know, he's an investor, blah, blah, blah. So I jumped on a flight from, you know, London to New York, met with Tom, partied on with him for like, you know, days. And then he wrote me a check and again, didn't read the IM. And I find these guys, and by IM, I mean information memorandum, which is like a kind of a deck if you're trying to raise money. But those guys, I think they kind of know after a while they're not investing in, you know, as much numbers and financials and, you know, projections and all that shit. I think for them, it's more the person.
Absolutely.
And if you show that you're going to get after it and you do get after it, then whether it's this business or whatever else, you know, that they do in the future, they'll probably achieve something because you've got that drive to
That's it. And that's where like that funnels down to even smaller things. It's like I'm bringing on my first employee for my program next year.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care what your qualifications are. I want the girl I got, she's an actual
The less the better, right? Because then you can teach them
you do it. All I know is she's got a phenomenal work ethic. She cares about it. She's been working for free and volunteering with me for ages. It's like she's earned it.
Yeah.
And it's like that's what a lot of companies want as well. They everyone needs to be qualified. That's the bare minimum. But then how are you as a person? Do you care? Like one of the quotes we love when it comes to almost probably this quote could sum up a lot of how you achieve what you do is people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Yeah.
And it's like, you just went, all right, I'm just interested in you. I'm curious. I care about you. And I'll give you some free products and stuff. Now that they know you care about them, then they go, all right, Patrick, tell me about your stuff. Let's grab coffee. Let's have a look at what you're doing. Rather than just going, look at my products. Look how cool I am. Do you want to invest?
Yeah, totally, man. And the guy in the gym, you know, he was wearing a gold Patek.
Which is like.
So I knew that my sort of in my head, the way it was working was I'll give him some products now and then he'll guaranteed to buy the next ones and I've got a new customer out of it. I didn't think he'd become like, you know, a great friend and a, you know, on my board and everything now. Yeah. And, you know, he's like, there was never the intention, but kind of worked out like that.
I think that's what I kind of love about the business world and life. It's not very structured.
No.
It's like stuff just happens. And the
craziest thing was like how all the skincare started. I mean, that's an even wilder story and you know, I'm sure everyone's heard it.
You were telling me about this. I remember this is a great
story.
Yeah,
the sauna in Chicago. Yeah. So
To clarify to listeners, so far in your story, you've done hair products, right?
Yeah.
So you haven't launched skincare yet.
It wasn't like, it was on the radar, but we didn't like, you know, we hadn't actively kind of pushed it yet. But when you work with Berlin Packaging in Chicago, they give you a corporate rate at the Four Seasons. So you get to stay at the Four Seasons for, I think it's $200 a night, which is crazy. If you've ever been to this hotel, it's like pimped out. It's amazing. So Amy and I were like, fuck it, let's stay for a week, right? Because it was so good. And we didn't have kids then. And then on the last day, I went in, I just said to Ames, I'm going to go for a sauna and hang out before we jump on the plane because it's a long flight back to Sydney. And I was hanging out in the sauna. I was probably there for 20 minutes, 25 minutes on my own. And the sauna is massive too. You can imagine what it's like in the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
And then this guy cruised in with like a towel over his shoulder and his dick swinging around. Like literally sat right next to me, like legs touching. And I was kind of like, we were laughing about it and, you know, joking around. And I said to him, fuck man, how good's the Four Seasons? And he was like, yeah, I know, it's sick, right? And I was like, did you see that Ferrari 599 at the front? And this is how long ago it was. That was a new car then. And he goes, the black one. I was like, yeah. And he goes, man, that's mine. I was like, holy shit. I was like, what do you do? Well, first I said, you must have been in one of the first people in the world to get one. Like, how'd you get that? And he goes, I was actually one of the first 10 in the States. And I was like, man, right on, like sick car. And I was like, what do you do? And he said, oh, I'm a neurosurgeon by profession, but I work for Bridgewater. And then he's a professor at Harvard and all these other universities and stuff over there. And I was like, sick, cool, man. He's like, what about you? And I was telling him about the hair care thing and we hadn't launched it at that point. We was just like in the process of doing it. And then, pardon me. Then he was like, do you know what, man? I was always thinking about doing like a women's skincare line because all the actives and all the stuff that we do is basically at the end of the day, like anti-aging. And I was like, cool, man. Sounds good. Cause he was, you know, going sort of abbreviating the story here. Mm. But, and I was like, man, it's a pretty crowded space though, you know, and not to be negative, but I was like, that's where the big girls and the big boys play. And like, it's a whole thing. You got to, you know, you'd have to do it full time. And he's like, yeah, I know. It's kind of why I haven't done it. And I said, why don't you do like a really high end men's one? And I said, I can't think of any off the top of my head that are like as crazy as you're talking about. And he was like, man, fucking good idea. And he goes, tell you what, he goes, you want to go halves in it? And he was like, I'll do all the back end science stuff and you brand it and then we'll go from there. I was like, fuck yeah. So, but by this stage, man, I'd been in the sauna. I was in there for probably 20 minutes, 25 like, minutes before he even got in.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And then this went for another, like probably half an hour. I was dying. By the end.
And you're trying to like, keep it cool.
Oh, in my head, I was going, hold in there, kid. This could be the best deal of your life.
Yeah. Oh, that's a class. That's a comedy skit.
Yeah,
right,
man, it was. It was like that. But it was real, you know? And then I was saying to the guy, like at the end, I was like, fuck, are you sure you're a doctor? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, man, because if I don't make it to the door, like roll me out.
Yeah.
And then, because I was like, oh, I'll leave my business card with the concierge. And I was obviously so hot and it cooked me really. And then I had to go to four different concierges at the hotel and give them a business card and try and explain to them that I met this guy who I couldn't remember his name. His name was Matt. I met this guy in the sauna who, you know, it was imperative that he's going to ask for this card and you've got to give it to him because it's like, you know, the next big thing. And that was kind of a bit embarrassing. I should have just said the guy with the black Ferrari.
Yeah, yeah, true, true, true.
I didn't
think
about it at the time. I was too hot. And I reckon I sweated for 3 days after that sauna.
This is so funny because I go, a little hack we have is the Sheraton Grand Hotel. It's just across Hyde Park.
Yeah, yeah.
So we found out, there's a bit of a secret. You can pay just for the membership, the health club. So we just go there every single morning. Steam room, sauna,
mate,
pool.
It's the best thing for
spa.
You.
I was there this morning actually.
Yeah.
And the steam room is unbelievable. You do 5 minutes and you're sweating like a pig in there.
Yeah.
And yeah, the same thing we were talking about. My mate does a game where when someone walks in, he tries to stay as long as them.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had someone, this big guy, walk in and he was just in there for like 10 minutes and he's just like, come on, I can do this. Like, it's such a mental battle.
Totally. Yeah, who was the two boxers famously that went in there?
Oh, yeah, it was like Mike Tyson and someone.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and he had to outlast him. Yeah, and then that gave him the edge in the fight.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. No, but yeah, man, that started kind of the whole skincare side of things. So this guy, he didn't email me either, so I didn't know if he'd got the card because it was like a week later I was thinking, fuck, this guy hasn't emailed me or anything yet. And then it was like a month and then it was like 3 months and I'm trying to track him down through like Harvard and Bridgewater is like a vault. You kind of, there's no chance of getting in there. But I just couldn't contact the guy. Anyway, about 6 months after, I got an email saying, hey, it's Professor Matthew During. I'm going to be in Sydney doing this TED Talk thing. I'd love to meet up with you and Ames because we'd launched the brand by then. And then, it took us for dinner down at Bondi at the beach and invested in the business. Plus then gave me all the kind of insights into what he thought, the proper levels of all this anti-aging stuff we should put in the products would be. And then I annoyed the shit out of Bentley Labs so much that they ended up taking a meeting with me after like 6 months. And then Matt and I went to Bentley and just blew their brains out with like an idea and a concept.
Mm.
And they loved it. They invested as well in the business. So that's what you can see now why we've got like 60 investors.
Yeah, I was about to say, I was just thinking, man, how many investors?
Everyone invests, yeah. But that's a good thing, right?
Yeah,
like it's good because then people give a shit then, you know what I mean? They've got a vested interest in it. They care about it. And it's pretty flattering to your idea or your concept if someone's willing to give you money to help, you know what I mean? And a lot of these people we use on our advisory board, which is really valuable as well. Setting that up is a good thing for young business people, if there's any 100%. Out there that are doing that.
Yeah.
Surround yourself with people that have done it before or, that can be strategic to you. It makes all the difference, man. Rather than kind of going bash, bash, bash and just winding your way to your goal, like these dudes just sort of keep you in a line and keep you going to that that final kind
and
of
for point. Anyone going, yeah, but how do I meet these people? Well, listen to the story.
They're all around you.
Yeah. You just got to be in the
probably
right place.
Next one at a cafe, listen to this.
You never know. You never know, honestly, though. But like,
you don't.
Something that blows my mind was Matthew, Dr. Matthew.
Yeah,
yeah. Like the fact that he'll remember you after 6 months.
Yeah.
And still like remember to reach out to you after six months. Because like in that position, he was the one, you wanted to probably contact him a lot more than he wanted to contact you, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And so it's just like the fact that he would be like, oh yeah, I'm going to Sydney. Oh yeah, that guy I met for 20 minutes naked in the sauna.
Yeah,
should take him out for dinner.
Yeah,
like that's crazy to me.
And it was
shows,
a funny sauna.
And it shows like probably why he's so successful. Like took a note. He obviously got your business card or I don't know.
Yeah, he did.
Or
he
Googled you or whatever.
No, he had the business card. He was just busy. But it turns out he sold 3 drugs to Pfizer in that sort of 6 months. So he was just under the pump, but made hundreds of millions of dollars.
Hundreds of millions?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
So him and his business partner, I read and I haven't really quizzed him about it. I think they sold 3 drugs for $1.2 billion US.
Holy crap.
And he was half of it. So, minus a bit of tax, he probably...
You're 200 mil or something.
Yeah, he's driving McLarens and everything else.
Oh,
yeah.
He's buying
he's
him out,
a good
right?
dude, man. That's the other thing. Like, I didn't know any of this shit when I met him.
Just like everyone else you're talking about.
Yeah. But like, he picked me up from a hotel and when I was staying in New York and we were going, I said, I have a meeting to talk about like, what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and all that. And he picked me up in like this old, shitty, beaten up RS4 Audi. And I was like, fuck, man, I thought you were rich. Like, what's this piece of shit? Where's a Ferrari? Because I love cars, man. I love cars. And I thought he was going to take me to a posh restaurant in a Ferrari. And it's the first time I've been in a Ferrari and all that sort of stuff. And he was like, piece of shit, huh? Check this out. And man, he just did a 4-wheel drift out of the hotel, like car park. Just going, wow.
Yeah.
This thing was just like a rally weapon. And then just scared the fuck out of me through New York at a million miles an hour. Like the buildings were going. And then we had like, I was just in hysterics going, who are you? And then we went and had a rad dinner and he bought like 10 grand's worth of wine and was just like, because he just made a load of money, right?
He was just
loving life. These guys, man, they work bloody hard. I don't feel like they get much of a chance to kind of, have fun because they're just always in the lab.
Well, that's always I guess I was talking about this with someone. I was like, how life works is like typically people who have lots of money work their ass off and don't have much time.
Exactly.
And people who don't have lots of money usually have a bit more time to like play video games or whatever. And it's like, how do you find that sweet spot where it's like make good money and you got time to see your kids or do cool life?
Well, now he's got kids and, you know, he's sort of out of the game. He's got enough to kind of kick back and he's got twin boys. He has a great time with them and they, you know, they do all sorts of stuff together.
Yeah. That's amazing. Wow.
But man, he's just like, just a great guy and like, so smart to have someone like that on your board that knows like what ingredients are coming up, what, you know, because a lot of the stuff that he had wasn't through FDA, so we couldn't use it because it was too kind of futuristic. But then by the time it all gets through, we can jump on it first. And I've always got him sort of on call to like look at our formulations and say, hey, you know, is this too much? Is this active going to work with this one? Is this going to be, you know, what level should we be using? Where's the clinicals done at? Because that's the other thing with like ingredients where the things that we do, whether it's hair loss or anti-aging or whatever, there's like a certain percentage. So you could put like 0.01% of, say, a retinol or a hyaluronic acid in something and then claim anti-aging. It's not going to do shit.
Right, right.
Because it's been, the clinicals were done at, say, 1% or 2% or whatever the percentage might be. So unless you use that percentage, then you can't, you're not going to get the performance out of the product. And for guys in particular, if they're not like, if the product doesn't work, they're not going to buy it again. But guys are super loyal, right? So if, you know, there's probably... however many people listen to this podcast, most of the guys will probably have the same shit in their cupboard that they've had for the last 5 or 10 years. Guys are super loyal to stuff. If it works, they'll just keep using it and they don't question it. Whereas women are a lot more likely to try a new product or a new brand or whatever, try what's cool. Whereas guys are loyal, man. Like if you get a product that works and you can get it into their regime, they'll use that shit forever, especially if it works.
You know, so you have a high like retention on customers.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of what we not pride ourselves on, but like, I think if you make good stuff, you get that.
Yep.
It's like a byproduct. It's like money, right? Like if you like what you do and you're really good at it, eventually money's going to be a byproduct of doing well at whatever you do.
I mean, my first mentor was like, if you can't make $1 million in partnerships and joint ventures, you should quit business.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the best way to start business. Yeah, it's just your partnerships and like, you know, referrals is the best way to grow business.
Yeah.
It's obviously slow,
yeah,
but it shows that your business is working. Once you've got high referrals, then you go, all right, let's take this online, let's scale it.
Well, that was a big thing why Mr. Porter loved us was we had like one of the highest reorder rates on their whole website. So it was us and Common Projects white sneakers were the two like most reordered things.
Typical.
And they're not high ticket items, you know, they're not like Gucci or Saint Laurent or Balenciaga or whatever, where you sell a jacket for 10 grand or something. But they just keep the guys coming back and coming back and coming back. And then hopefully they buy a pair of sunnies and they buy a wallet and they buy a bag and then a suit and whatever else and kind of keep them as a customer coming back to the website. But that only comes if you make good shit, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what's moving, are you guys looking at expanding into new products? Are you?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you've got this brand, right? And for anyone, I mean, I'll do my best to try to describe it. But for anyone listening, when you look at like your products, I mean, you hate to compare it to like Apple or anything, but it's like you can see you've got that very minimal, very like masculine, it's very nice branding.
Yeah,
like it's simple, it's clean. You've got that branding established where you could bring in like other products because you've got the brand there that people would go, well, if the skincare is so high quality, I'm sure their watches or whatever bullshit is going to be high quality as well.
Man, we've looked at a bunch of that stuff and being compared to Apple or anyone else like that is the highest compliment.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, you know, all
of our design stuff, like if you had to send my mood board, you know, 10 years ago, it was... all Apple products, you know what I mean? Even the aluminium billet that we use on our packaging is the same aluminium billet that Apple used.
Yeah.
And no one knows that shit except for me.
Yeah.
But I was like, we've got to use it. Because the packaging company wanted to use like stickers and stuff where it looks like aluminium. I was like, no, fuck that. Use real aluminium. And things like that, which then it sort of pays you back in the long run. But there's a lot of car design in there as well. There's a lot of like form over function. So everything had two locks because it's expensive. So everything was thought about sort of like... if you have an expensive product, guys are probably going to take it with them to the gym or on holidays or, you know, business trips or whatever. So you don't want this thing to leak in their bag and, you know, potentially ruin a nice suit or jackets or whatever and be like a problem thing. Like I bought it, I remember buying, and no offense to Tom Ford because I love Tom Ford, but I bought a Tom Ford moisturizer in America maybe like 10 years ago or something, maybe 8 years ago, whatever it was. And it was like $180 or something. I was like, and for me at the time, that was like, holy shit, that's like
still a lot.
So much money for like this little moisturizer. Anyway, I've chucked it in my bag and, you know, did it up and everything the way I was supposed to, and then got back to Sydney and the whole thing had just like blown apart. It was all over my clothes and it was just like, I was like, fucking hell, surely Tom Ford would put a little bit more effort into their packaging at $180 and it's got Tom Ford's name on it, which, you know, should be in like scream quality to me. Or at least functionality, but it just had nothing. So that like that then sort of drove me to make sure all our stuff doesn't ever do that.
Right.
And then the design, you know, the design's my favorite bit, man. I actually just did a design presentation to Volvo in the States.
Really?
Yeah, they've got my mate's the head designer, and they're basically designing a concept car to launch in a year and a half at this motor show that's sort of trying to take Volvo from being a just a, you know, family, synonymously safe car,
yeah, yeah.
To something kind of futuristic and a bit more kind of sporty, as what they call it. And did a 3-hour design talk to all these, you know, car designers, which for me was like porno, you know.
Yeah,
you had to go into this bunker and there's no phones, you got to sign NDAs and, you know, you can't mention what you see on the walls and everything. And it was just unbelievable. It was like design heaven if you're into cars and design. But then they love to – so the head designer, Nick, he brings in designers from all different – so like architects and musicians and like all kinds of different product designers to give his guys like a different perspective on things so they can come up with something different. But yeah, like that was like phenomenal to see how the big guns do it, because usually I just draw it on a piece of paper and then send it to Chicago. And they're like, what the fuck is this, man?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's unreal. And is that something you want to, I guess, because, I mean, are you building this business to sell it? Or you're not sure?
Yeah, I don't know. That's one thing, like, and again, for the youngsters out there listening, if they haven't started a business, or even if you have and you know what you're doing, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, my whole thing is to start with the end, right? So, and the reason I did that was because I have investors. I couldn't afford to do this on my own, so I had to raise money to get the brand to where it is now. And to do that, like when you take on investors, you do have to give them their money back eventually, and usually with a percentage on it, you know, whether it's a multiple or a percentage.
Yeah, so actually that was a question for you. When you raise investment, are you giving a portion of your company, or are you giving like a promise to pay it back extra?
So say the first raise that I was talking about before, like it was $250,000 at a 2.5 mil valuation. So that's 10%.
Right.
So I'd have to give away 10% of the business. And then we did the same thing. We did half a mil at 5 mil, which is another 10% of the business. So we're down to like 80%.
Yeah.
And then as you go on, then we did the 2 mil at the 12.5. That was another kind of
11%,
15-20%, whatever it worked out to be. And then all of a sudden, so your percentage gets lower, but the business is worth way more money.
Mm.
So then you've got that idea and you've got to get it into your head of like, it's better to have, you know, a small percentage of something worth a fortune than 100% of nothing, right? And that was the only way we could do it.
Assuming your investors are good, and because I know people often will bring on investors who just want to, because they've got a portion of the company, they want to dictate certain things and it can cause friction.
Yeah, and I can spot that in 5 minutes, man. Right, I can have a coffee with someone and see if they're going to be a pain in the ass. And we've said no to way more investors than we've said yes to. And most of the people that we have are like, you know, they're kind of strategic to us, but good people more than anything. You know, I can always call them whether, you know, for whatever problem it is, and they can usually help me out. And it was talking to me, Amy and I were talking about this the other day, like, 99% of the problems you have in any business, and they're fucking big problems and they stress you out and you feel like fucking hanging yourself sometimes, but 99% of the time they've been solved by someone else. So the knowledge is there if you want it. Yeah. Like if you know how to, if you research it, you can usually find the solution. But then, yeah, going back to like sort of starting with the end. So if someone gives me money, right, like I pretend I'm the fund on the other side buying the whole brand. So it's sort of like, and that's sort of, you know, starting with the end is, okay, what would these guys, girls want to buy? And for us, it was like you'd want something in men's because it's like the fastest growing sort of space. It's the one that hasn't been tapped into as much. You want something in luxe because the margins are generally good. You want something that has the best distribution but doesn't have too much distribution. And that's what I was talking about before, where we don't have salons and barbershops and that kind of thing. So it means that someone could look at us and go, hey, I could see how we could get $100 million out of these guys in year one, you know, just plugging it into our network. Right. So always through the lens of like, who's going to buy the business?
That's really
smart.
Who
have they bought in the past? How much? What was the multiple they paid? What revenue were they doing? And really drilling in on like, what got that deal done? And there's like 1,000 of them if you look. They get done all the time. So the data's there if you want it. So then I work back from that point. So I'm like, okay, what revenue mark do we have to be at? And also surrounding myself with like, you know, I've got Sean Harrington, who's the owner of Elemis, who's just the fucking greatest guy on earth. I love the dude, man. He's a bit older than me, and he'll kill me for saying that. But, you know, he's done it before. He built up a brand and sold it for $910 million. You know what I mean? To L'Occitane. And now I'm good friends with the guy who runs L'Occitane as well. But those guys they've been through the whole journey, right? So I can ring them up and we have a Zoom, or, you know, I go to Perth and hang out in Sean's yacht. Fills me full of expensive red wine.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great. It's like the best thing ever, right? He's like, we call him Australian Dad because he's like our business dad. Everything he tells me to do, man, I just do it. Because he's been through that massive journey before. But he'll be like, all right, guys, you need more products, you need more doors, you need to build up your D2C side of the business. And then we're like, cool, how do we do that? And he's like, all right, go into this, this, and this. And not that he tells us how to do everything, he just gives us advice and stuff. Mm. But I follow what he's done because he's done it. He's got the exit. You know, and there's so many brands that sort of get halfway and then fizzle out. Whereas I think if you surround yourself with these people that like have done it before, they give you little tricks and tips to keep you going. Because it is hard, man. Sometimes you're like, fuck, you know, why am I doing this? And it can be like being like bipolar, literally. Like one email, you're like, yes, this is fucking unbelievable. You know, you're so pumped. And then 2 seconds later, you're like, fuck, how are we going to get out of this?
Happened to me last week.
Yeah.
I had like a huge win on Tuesday night. And I was just like going, great. Then bang, I got his email. And I was like, it knocked me out for an hour or two. I just sat there. I was just like trying to distract myself. Because I was like, it was just classic as well. I'm so used to that. It's I find, I don't know if you've had the same thing.
It jades you a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, I feel like I'm not as emotional. I don't let myself experience a full range of emotions as other people because I just keep myself kind of here.
Yeah.
I don't get too excited because I know it'll crumble. Yeah. I don't get too upset because I can bring myself back, which means I'm not having these huge highs because I just like, all right, every time I get a cool opportunity, my first thing is there's like a 90% chance it's not going to go through.
Yeah.
So don't get too excited because most of the opportunities that come my way, people flake or something happens or whatever. Yeah, and there's still some that go through, but I don't get too excited. Have you had the same sort of thing?
Mate, 100%. But just before I tell you about that, I was just talking, pretty much everyone I know, this is good advice for your guys, like that's really wealthy or, you know, really successful. Generally, they've made all their money through property.
Mm.
Always. Like all the time. One of my neighbor, he's a fucking legend, like lovely guy. He's a boob surgeon and he's probably the best in the country, if not one of the best in the world, you know, he's amazing. But he made most of his money through property. And the surgeon stuff obviously got him a start. Which is hard for young people now because it's so expensive and it is hard to get a start. But man, if you can get your foot in the door, like my whole thing was funded by that place in Marimbula.
Yeah.
60 grand.
Yeah.
You know, I got it for 53 because the government at the time were giving you 7 grand as a first home buyer's thing. Mm. So I had 53,000 bucks over 30 years or whatever. It's not that much. It was like 20 to 50 bucks a week. I can't even remember. But it was very minimal. It was just an automatic thing. And then it went up like by 200 grand, which at the time, you know, it was so much money.
But still, I mean,
it still is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For most people, something went up.
But that started the business, the salon, which then started all this. So that was like the catalyst for all of it. My business is my asset now.
Yeah,
so
same with me.
Every buck goes into that.
So do I. I put everything into this.
Yeah, yeah.
Just reinvest into the business because that's the biggest ROI, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Could flop, but, you know, it could, might not. But like, you know, boob surgeon or the, you know, or the guy you met in the sauna, like, they must be on insane wages.
Yeah.
But where's their money come from?
Exactly.
Assets.
Yeah, and wages, man, half of it goes to the tax man.
Yeah.
So they've got, you know, they're not dumb, these guys. They've got like ways to, you know, everything's a strategy.
You know? I mean, the event, if you're smart with a high wage, then you can transfer a lot more money into assets a lot faster.
100%.
But most people don't, you've probably seen it. Yeah. Lifestyle inflation, man.
Yeah, yeah.
People have lots of money. They just spend more and more and more.
Yeah,
they're on
yeah.
corporate 250K a year. Yeah. They just
and
have
God
a nice
bless
car.
All the young dudes who buy like Lambos and shit.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck to you.
An expensive hair product.
yeah.
What you're saying, like, man, we just worked on a deal for the last 11 months and eventually and said no to it.
Mm.
And it was the biggest waste of time ever. But I try and look at it like, you know, it's like the best lesson ever. Because at the start it was, the deal was $2.5 million with access to $30 million at a 17.5 mil valuation. So it was a fairly good valuation. It was cheap, you know, now it would probably be more like 50. But this was 12 months ago, like exactly 12 months ago. It was November last year. And flew to London, met with these guys. I knew them all, great people. And, you know, you're talking about getting $2.5 million in the bank, which is a big chunk of change for us. We could keep up with all our growth because we've gone from, you know, 100 grand a month to almost $1 million a month, or we'll do $1 million a month this month. And just to have the security to be able to fund everything without worrying about it all the time or waiting for revenue to catch up. Cause I don't want like kind of organic growth, you know what I mean? I want to smash this thing out while it's hot.
Mm.
And anyway, we worked on the deal and it was 8 months, man, or 9 months of due diligence. And it was the most gnarly, ball ache, waste of fucking time due diligence I've ever encountered. We've got a data room, right? Like on Dropbox, you could literally see where I last shat. Like every single thing of the company's 10-year history is in that data room. And then they'd ask for more shit and more shit. And you're like, guys, in the end, I was like, You fucking serious? Like, come on, it's 10 months now. Like, sure, there's no skeletons in the cupboard here. Like, so does you've got access to everything.
Over 10 months, surely the company's evaluation's gone up. Was that
I think that's what they plan on happening is the opposite, right? So they
could get a good deal.
Yeah, well, they lock you into this like exclusivity thing where you're not allowed to talk to anyone else.
Wow.
So it was a £250,000 fine if I spoke to any other people about raising money.
Wow.
So they've got you locked in, and then they hope that, I think what this is their strategy anyway, is that they kind of wear you down with so much due diligence that you're not working on the business, therefore the revenue drops, therefore they can get a better valuation.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Well, that's what a lot of venture capital does, man. They're not your mates. Yeah. They're like fucking vultures.
Yeah.
But they can also be really strategic at the same time.
If you get the right one.
They're there to make money, and I think if you think anything else, you're tripping. You know what I mean? But anyway, they just drilled us and drilled us and drilled us, and then at the last minute, they put in these like leaver provisions, which it's not like a leaver that you pull. It's like if I leave the business. So if I died or if I, went and worked for Tom Ford or someone else or whatever, there's all these different scenarios that play out with my shares, right? So if I died, their thing was that they could buy the business for a 90% discount at the current valuation for the next 4 years on that current valuation. I was just like, no fucking way. Like, that would go to my kids or my wife or like my mates or my other investors. Like, there's no chance. And that was, man, that was after 10 months of just like, oh. And then the original 2.5 mil that they were going to put in, they dropped $1 million out of that because one of the guys, you know, had a bit of financial trouble in the UK. This is like only a couple of months ago because everything's kind of tightened up a bit over there. So it was ended up being 1.5 and they didn't know when they were going to get the other million. And I was just like, guys, it just, and eventually we're just like, fuck, we're out.
Mm.
And then, man, and I'm really not religious. So I'm probably quite the opposite.
Can I guess then something happened? Yeah, you met someone.
Like an hour later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always the case.
The guy I met on a plane.
It's always the case. Pace, my mate. So he's you meet him after this. He's a musician. He's been doing music for 10 years. Mm. We do a bunch of other stuff. And he's never wanted to sign with a record deal because they're pretty shit usually.
Yeah.
And he was working with this company in Switzerland. They reached out to him and said, hey, we've got this opportunity, blah, blah, blah. You can do it like this. And he was like, yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Spent a few $1,000s in legal fees, getting the contract sorted. Then they go, actually, nah. And they pull out. And he's like, no, devastating.
Yeah.
A week later, TikTok reaches out and say, hey, we're launching the first ever TikTok music record label.
Yeah.
And we know you're a great creator. Did you want to be one of the first ever musicians to sign with our record label?
Hell yeah.
Now TikTok basically dominates the entire music industry right now.
Yeah.
If you get a viral sound.
Yeah.
And now he signed with them.
How good.
It's the same with everything. Like I had a similar story almost, except it was 200 grand and it was 6 months, but I was working with a crypto company and the CEO came on the podcast for free.
Yeah.
He was going to pay, but I was like, nah, because I wanted to build a relationship. Yeah, he just came for free. He flew out, had a great chat and everything. And then we're talking with these guys and they were going to pay me like 10 grand a month. Which was insane. I've never had stability ever.
Yeah, yeah.
I still don't have stability.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like,
don't
do
it to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. It was 120 grand a year. And I was like, that'll buy me so much time. Yeah. This will set me, I can focus on the business without worrying about finances. We do this, we sign the deal. And then this stuff is like 6 months going back and forth. And then we find out something out falls through. Then I do another deal with another like crypto one. It's another 6 months of going back and forth. And then they go, oh, we actually just think your audience isn't right for what we're doing. And I'm like, my audience hasn't changed.
Yeah,
it was
the same
6 months ago. What kind of cop out is that?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I was like, but same thing. One of the guys, he introduced me to someone else and they became the first sponsor of the podcast. I didn't get 100 grand, but I got 5 grand a month.
Yeah, and here we are.
For doing like very little. And you know, they worked with me for 3 or 4 months. And that was cool. So I mean, there's always learnings you can take from those things.
100%, man. And like, you know, they even accused us of, because one of my investors is the best, you know, he's by far the best M&A lawyer in the country. I think he's 7 or 8 times M&A lawyer of the year in Australia. And they said that we bought a machine gun to a knife fight.
Mm.
I was like, well, of course. Like, surely that would be a good thing, like if you were trying to invest heavily in a business, right, that the business is like using the best of whatever resources it has. Like all this crazy shit happened, man. But then... yeah, then the guy that I met on the plane from London back to Sydney, Adrian, he was just like, mate, he's like, first of all, he goes, who are these jokers?
Yeah.
He's like, mad Scottish accent. And again, he didn't really know about him. And he was like, fuck, he's like, guys, stop the deal. He's like, I'll just give you 2.5 and put 10% clip on it and pay me back and we're good.
Wow.
That was literally an hour later.
Mm.
It's like, oh.
10 so months got to, the money, to 20 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But now debt is a bit different to capital because you've got to pay it back, right?
Yeah.
Which is a little bit of a looming thing over the back of your head always.
Of course.
But the revenue is good enough now to kind of pay the debt with no problems.
Mm.
But yeah, so we'll build on now probably and do a much bigger raise in February next year. So that was kind of like temp cap. And because the growth has just been crazy, man. Like, I don't know if we've talked about it, but like this shampoo thing that we've done, that's like, it's $100 shampoo and conditioner. We basically gave an open budget to the lab and said, hey, create like the best possible shampoo and conditioner on the planet. Knowing it was going to be crazy. Amy didn't think it was going to work. You know, no one's going to pay $100 for a shampoo and a conditioner. And man, we sold 6,000 in like 2 days and then sold another pre-sale 10,000 like in a week. We've just made another 50,000, like half of that's gone. Everyone's screaming for it. We can't make it fast enough, but it's so expensive to make. It costs like millions of dollars to make.
Yeah, right.
Because you've got to make, you know, 50,000 times, you know, $50. Gets pretty expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a good position to be in. Raising money for growth is way better than trying to go out and raise money when your company's doing shit.
You know? I think it's, I mean, my suspicion would be like, especially for me, like I don't wash my hair that often.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have that much hair compared to girls. So it's like a bottle will last you for ages.
Yeah.
So like $100 for a bottle for a guy versus for a girl is a big difference because this might last them a month. This might last us six months. Yeah.
Mate, I have so much shampoo and conditioner. And I use all our stuff, right? And I use SH2 and CD2. I kind of selfishly made that for me.
Yeah.
You'd like it because you got thick hair as well. But it lasts me anywhere from 3 to 6 months.
Mm.
You know, so then when you average, like if it's $45 or whatever to buy per month, it's not that bad.
Mm.
And it's not like the cheap shit you get in the chemists and the supermarkets or whatever. And, you know, smells good, stops your hair falling out, works good, you know, looks cool.
It's absolutely incredible. Like I love the story you've built, and I love the, you know, the lesson. I think the main lesson here, if anyone listening, should just be the networking thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's not like, I mean, networking is like, sounds very intentional, right?
Yeah,
it's like, I've got to go network with them. It's like, you're just on the plane, you're naked in the sauna with your dicks out, you know?
I wasn't, he was.
Yeah, you're boxing with a guy with a golden watch. You went to the networking event. It's just being open to opportunities, being genuinely curious in people without that kind of intention of like, how can I make money out of this or whatever?
Yeah, exactly.
If you just be genuinely curious and interested, you might make money as a byproduct, or you never know. Maybe in 5 years' time, you reconnect with them.
Yeah, like that happens all the time on LinkedIn.
All the time.
Yeah.
I was at this event, I mentioned to you, the Amazon Prime event, and this guy comes up to me and he goes, oh, were you with KPI? When I was 18, the company I was working with when I was 18, he goes, I remember you.
Yeah.
He's like, what are you doing now? You're doing the podcast stuff? I was like, yeah, I am. I was telling him, I've got this company. I've got a few programs now. We're working with a bunch of things. Got 3 or 4 podcasts now. And he's just like, that's incredible. And then Pace came over, my mate, he's a musician. And this is a guy we're going to lunch with today at 2 o'clock to discuss like opportunities.
Yeah.
And that's just cause someone I met 5 years ago came up and like recognized me and you know, just being open to everything really.
100%, man. It's been, that's also a good, you know, what rule of not being an asshole or like not burning your bridges because it's a small world, you know, and you don't want to be that guy. And I've seen people do it and it just destroys them down the track. You know what I mean? Whereas if you're good, I find if you're good to everyone and try and help where you can, it does pay you back. And the other thing too is I think if you're going to get into business or like start your own company in particular and you need lots of capital, like learn how to raise it. It's not that – it cost me $25,000 to do that advanced diploma of corporate finance, and it wasn't at a university. I paid, you know, a premium to do it here in Sydney. And I didn't have the money, so I just got a credit card. ANZ gave me a credit card. Stupid fucks. I just lied on the form, right? And made up this crazy income.
Yeah.
And they didn't even check it. But got 25 grand, right, on a credit card, just paid it and then paid it off. But doing that, understanding how that world works, because it's a complicated, it's not as easy as I kind of made it out to be.
But again, we've got 1 hour, not 5.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of like, but if you can understand the process and how it works and understand the way other people would look at your business, so have their view of it, so what do they want to make out of it? What's in it for them? You know, all that kind of stuff. Then you'll raise money every day of the week. And then business is easy, man.
Because you were talking like, before we go to the final question, I remember this, I don't know if this came up one-on-one or if you were talking on stage when I met you. You were like working with a Batman or something?
Oh, yeah. That was a whole other, I forgot about that.
Yeah, there you go. Robert Pattinson Batman.
Yeah, yeah. So Warner's reached out maybe probably a year ago now. And it was just a US number that came up on my phone and I was like, I usually would never answer. It was like 6 a.m. and my kids were going crazy and I was like, hello. And she's like, oh, it's Sunny from Warner Brothers. And I was like, hey, what do I fucking owe you? Thinking the kids had downloaded something or some app or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it was. She's like, oh, no, I wanted to talk to you like about the Batman. And I was like, oh yeah, sick. And it hadn't been released at that point. And I was like, yeah, yeah, like, what?
Yeah. Say no more, I'm in.
Yeah. And then basically, in a nutshell, what they were trying to do was make, because COVID had happened and they'd already filmed the Batman, and they were, you know, DC were, and I'm sure they won't mind me saying, this is what they said to me, DC were getting their asses kicked by Marvel for the last however long.
Decade.
Yeah. And they wanted to come out with a new kind of hero, you know, franchise was the Batman, and it was a new director, a new take on the Batman, being Rob Pattinson. And a killer director and everything else. And they were like, look, the other thing for us is that we don't think we're going to get the bums on seats that we would have because of COVID and people are scared to go to the theatre and stuff. So we want to make the franchise a little bit more like James Bond, where you can, if you're a fan of the film, you can buy the products that are featured in the film. So it's like the Aston Martin cars or the Heineken. Omega watches. Yeah, Heineken, Tom Ford, all that kind of stuff. So Warner's and DC had the idea of having like basically a real life Wayne Enterprises company set up in the States. And then they would collaborate with the best brands to create products for Wayne Enterprises, which would then be featured in the film.
Far
out. So there's, Lamborghini, Persol, Globetrotter.
Wow.
And she was like, basically, do you want to be a part of it? And I was like, fuck yeah. Like, of course, yeah. And I was like, how'd you find out about us? And I was like, there was two kind of ways in, but one of them, one of the writers from DC, they were talking about like a grooming brand. And he said, oh, there's this like small brand out of Sydney in Australia that I don't think anyone's ever heard of, but they're like, you'd probably expect to see this shit in Bruce Wayne's cupboard. Like, it's amazing. You don't have to change the design. You know, it looks like it would be in.
Because it's like silver, like, it looks like Batman design.
Batman wasn't a part of the aesthetic, but it's everything's monochromatic and like, you know, we try and keep it sort of super modern. Like, cause the thing that annoys me is like, the 5 million barber products that are out there that have like pirates on them or, you know, sailing ships. I'm just like, Christ, if I see another one of these brands, I'm going to hang myself. It's like, who wants to buy that fucking old school shit that like was cool 50 years ago? Like, technology has moved so far. Like, I like vintage cars, but they're hard to drive. Yeah, man. They're unreliable.
No power steering.
Yeah, everything sucks about them. They look good.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I'm more like, you know, and each to their own with all that kind of stuff. But I'd rather be using something that was at the pointy end of what's possible as far as technology.
You know, the dream car I saw on Top Gear, Aston Martin DB5 with all new internals.
Yeah.
So all the engine, everything's reliable, but all the exterior is old school.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I like vintage stuff, but that when you're putting stuff on your body and in your body and, you know, I just kind of think like, surely you wouldn't do a thing that was 50 years old.
Mm.
Like, you know what I mean? There's way better stuff out there. But yeah, I digress about my hatred of all things.
Yeah.
Pirate ship and beard on hair products.
The Batman thing's awesome.
But then the Batman thing, man, that went crazy, right? Yeah. That was one thing we were looking at, like doing a black nail polish because I've already done it. And some kind of eyeshadow.
That would be killer if you could get him like, because that would integrate really well.
Yeah.
If you get him like just taking the product out and put it on his face or something.
And then
putting a mask on and going out.
Yeah, that'd be sick.
That'd be pretty flawless as well.
Yeah.
In terms of integration.
Yeah.
Anyways. Mate, great conversation. We're back on now.
Yeah, we jumped to a little bit of everything.
We switched on. As usual, I always finish with one question, and that's very simple. It's what advice would you give to an 18-year-old today?
Oh, man. That's a loaded question.
Take your time.
I'd probably say, like, figure out what you're good at. And to tell 18-year-olds, you don't have to know when you're 18. Mm. Like, who fucking knows when you're 18?
No one.
You know, you're just trying to jerk off as much as you can and... Yeah. Whatever else when you're 18. Like, you know, there are very few that know what they're going to do in their life when you're 18. So, yeah, man, it's a hard question to answer. Like, I guess finding out what you're good at and then doing that isn't work, if that makes sense.
Mm.
So, like, if it's fun and you dig it and you really want to do it, you'll probably be better at it than anyone else because you actually want to do it and it doesn't seem like work. Probably be my advice. Like, the property thing I think is great for what, because you're not everyone can do like the business thing, and it's not for everyone. It's fucking hard work.
I'd say it's not for most people.
No, it's not. And we joke about the 1%ers, right? Like, there's only 1% of all my friends and everyone I know that actually get after it, because it's fucking hard, and you don't sleep. Like, it's all consuming.
And you're always on,
you're never off. You know, and you have to, you know, I try and make time to go to the gym or go for a sauna for an hour or whatever just to, like, calm the jets down. But, like, basically I just come out of there with a whole bunch of new ideas.
So do I, yeah.
Which is good, right? But you got to slow down and then kick up again. But, yeah, I don't know, man. You're speaking to a minority of, like, if you've going to do what I did. But man, I didn't do it perfect. I fucked it up.
This is who listens to the podcast, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People who are listening to this podcast aren't just people who want to, you know, jerk off all day and do nothing. They're usually listening to this because they want to.
No, I didn't mean, I meant just 18-year-olds in general. Yeah, you know what I mean? That's like the state you're in, right? You've got hormones raging. And,
for sure. Yeah. I mean, and I agree. Like most,
and you're not thinking about the future. You're probably vaping or smoking darts and getting pissed and, you know, health and all that isn't a huge concern because you're bulletproof when you're 18, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's hard, or it's probably too much to expect for 18-year-olds to know exactly, unless they're an athlete or something, which might be a bit different.
Even then.
You've generally come up through the ranks and, you know, you're probably already quite good at what you do.
Even then, like, when do you wear out pretty early as an athlete?
Exactly. Man, I've seen so many people, unfortunately, like, the second their career's over, they're 30, 35, and they've got no qualifications, can't do anything, and, like, end up packing boxes in a factory.
Yeah.
Going from, like, the heights of, you know, whatever career they were at. I've seen that like in person and not end well as well. It's gnarly. But yeah, man, I wish I'd like to text you back on that question.
Dude, text me back. That's fine.
I'd love to give an answer that
send me a voice memo.
Would actually like.
Send me a voice memo. I'll just plug it into the end of this.
Yeah. Or maybe that would help someone out. You know what I mean? I reckon it's more just that you don't feel the pressure to know what you have to do or what you're going to do because things will change and they always do and they'll change for the better. And they'll get smarter and better at whatever it is and they'll figure out eventually what they, you know, want to do in their life. And even if they don't, that's cool too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with a 9-to-5 job, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Imagine the peace in your mind of like quitting at 5 and going home and not thinking about work.
Oh, I fantasize about it.
Fuck, man.
Imagine the peace of mind knowing you're going to get paid this much every single week.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get sick days.
In fact, any 18-year-old, go get a normal job.
Yeah, I know.
And you won't have depression or anxiety or any other fucking thing that comes along with like running your own business.
Yeah, no, like I love running business, but I mean...
Well, it's hard, right? Like
I love what I do. I absolutely love what
so
I do, but I never switch off. Even in the sauna today, I'm like, I just want to try to calm my mind, but I just can't. I'm always thinking of ideas. And then,
But man, use it while you're young too, because it fades off, you know, by the time you're sort of 40 or 50. I mean, you'll be a lot smarter, but the energy of youth is like
absolutely
amazing, you know, and make the most of it. And travel. That would probably be my thing if you're 18, in all, you know, realistically, get a ticket, go around the world. Check it all out.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing out there. It's crazy and horrifying at the same time, but like mind-bogglingly beautiful and awesome too.
No, I agree. I always say that. Take risks, travel. Yeah. You know, you don't have to know what you want to do. They're all good pieces of advice. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Patrick.
Thanks so much for having me.
Where's the best place to go if people want to follow you online, check out your stuff?
Patrick's Products on Instagram. We're going for a blue tick. Nice. And the products are available on the website in all countries.
Yep. Yeah.
And we've got some amazing new stuff coming out, sort of drilling down on what it is that we're good at and getting better and better at it. A few collabs coming too, which is going to be cool.
Mm.
Yeah. Big ones too. Some heroes of mine, finally.
Yeah, nice.
I feel like we're getting to that point now where we can actually add a bit of value.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe get some free gear as well.
That's awesome, man. No, that's so cool. So good on you for doing everything you do. Appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. And likewise, man, keep, you know, anything you can do to help those kids get on the right track and, you know, do it how you do it.
No,
all good.
It's awesome. It's awesome. But thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it.